The comment you made was that if you looked at the ring interferometer, that everything was always transmitted. And I want to convince you that that's not true. Did any of you go back and look at this again? No? Okay. Let's look at it quickly. Because, part of the fun of physics is to struggle with something until you can say, oh yes, I understand that. So we had this piece. And the way I set it up, get my notation correct, is like this. So, and I suggested that you put in, you think about a plane wave. And I misled you in, I think you saying, oh, well, let's take this as though this was a potential that we're scattering off, and so that we would think about some plane wave impinging on a potential. And if you do that, one, it wouldn't be these two sides that you would want to get right. You'd want to get it right at this interface, and then you would need to include dynamical diffraction theory, which is fun, but messy. And if you go through that, then you end up locking the phases of those. At least I think you do. As I solved it, I did. And if you lock the phases of those two, then there's nothing that can happen but being transmitted. And we don't want that. So here I say, okay, we've got this piece. We're going to put in a phase. And I want to know, well, what's the input state, right? This is what I'm imagining as the input state. Of course, we're interested in a wave coming in, something being transmitted, and something being reflected. But the input state to this is going to be this, right? Because I have to say, oh yeah, something was reflected. And then, of course, we're going to care that there's a normalization in this. And so you see a built-in the reflected piece already. And then if you take this state, psi in, and you apply it to that, and then you let it evolve. You look at that map, right? U is just a map. Then you end up, it was working before. There we go. You end up with these two conditions. So I sent you the link for this. You end up with these two conditions. And then I've plotted the modulus of A and B here as a function of phase. And so you see that, they're nicely complementary as you would like them to be. You also see that you can't, and I did this, of course, for 50-50, that you can't get to condition where there's only transmitted or only reflected. And I think that that makes sense. Though I'm still thinking a little bit about it. That if you had only transmitted and only reflected, I'm worried that you built in an inconsistency. You say, oh, it's only transmitted, so everything goes this way. And the reason everything goes this way is I have the interference between these two paths, right? And so then, it sounds like an incorrect circular argument. We have a circular argument, we at least like it to be consistent. So that's my take on this. Now, I haven't thought about it very hard because I don't like to solve. If I give you a problem, I don't like to solve it, right? It's a little bit. If I give you a problem that I just want you to do the math for, I solve it. But if I give you the problem that you're supposed to come with some creativity, it seems not quite fair to come with my own. But have a look at it and see if you agree. And I didn't, in the notebook, include the generalization of you so that one could say that it's not 50-50. And that, of course, will change things. And so you might want to look at that as well. Yeah? Yeah.
Way that you've written things down, the phase is one way.
So the phase you pick up going this way, and so you need to, of course, give yourself a map, and then I think I've consistently applied the map over that. Yeah.
First one going in, it splits into two, right?
Right, so
you have a phase going the other direction as well. Like, is stuff only traveling in one direction, or is it traveling in the other direction as well?
You're saying in this loop.
Yeah.
You know, since I'm thinking about this as a stationary piece, then nothing is traveling in this loop. Yeah. The only thing that's happening in this loop is that there's a standing wave.
Does that blade act like being split in the sense that it splits it into
particles?
Yeah, it has to. And
right.
Then that particle travels in.
Right. So you don't like my definitions here?
No, it's just that you said, well, Nico asked, does the
right.
It pick up phase only in one direction? And I understood it to mean that.
So my answer to that is there's a map. Right. And so you pick up a phase in this arm, you don't pick up a phase over here. Yeah? So I don't promise that this is the most insightful or even the correct solution. It has some features that looks correct to me. But I'm happy to sit down and explore it and, you know, you come with ideas, we'll compare and see. Yeah? But I don't think, and I should have caught that, I don't think the correct answer is that it's just transmitted. And, you know, I think that if you just, you know, pretend that you can open Griffiths and find the solution, I think that composition is not the right way to go about the problem. Good, and we're going to get together on Wednesday at 5 at Rack 2. I hope that you can all come. And so there's always a good time to talk about some more physics there too. We can come back to that. Okay. And as you come, of course, I'm always hoping to find new graduate students. So, you know, we'll think about recruiting as well. Okay, I want to change to magnetic resonance. So the neutron interferometry case was the case to say, here's as simple as physics gets, and that we can really get our mind around everything that happens to it. And the point of magnetic resonance is to say, here's how we have a larger tensor product space, and so that it'll still be quite simple. All physics is simple, but it'll be a little bit more complicated space. And we're going to talk about spin 1/2 particles, so we have a magnetic dipole, and we're going to place them in a static magnetic field. Which I'll orient along the z-axis. So we have a field that's pointing along the z-axis. And, you know, magnetic dipoles are great. That the only thing you have are magnetic-magnetic interactions. You know, nothing's moving, so there's no relativistic pieces here. And so, you know, the energy is just m dot b. And mu is just the magnetic moment. Let me use sigma. And this is the gyromagnetic ratio. Which is just the strength of the magnetic moment, of course. And the gyromagnetic ratio is a constant for protons ...4,000 hertz per Gauss. Remind you that we walk around in a half Gauss field, the Earth's field. And so everywhere there's a noise at 2 kilohertz as you walk around. And years ago, I was involved in an experiment where we mapped that out in Zurich, which is a noisy place. You know, there's lots of sources of noise. But it's easy to find the signal from the water sitting around in the earth for this. Typically, since we're going to apply a big field, our fields will be of order a few Tesla. Helps to remember that 10 to the 4 Gauss is equal to 1 Tesla. So we're not usually that interested in small things. All right. And so we can look at the energy levels, this splitting, as a function of the magnetic field. And of course, we'll find that there's two of them. Turns out that the gyromagnetic ratio can have either sign. And so you can choose any convention you want. For protons, it happens to be positive, which we can get from molecular beam experiments. It's hard experimentally to pick up what the sign is. And for silicon, it's negative. Of course, any nucleus that has an odd number of neutrons or protons has a magnetic moment, right? And so things that have magnetic moments are proton, which is spin 1/2, deuterium, which is spin 1, tritium, which is, again, spin 1/2, carbon-13 is spin 1/2. carbon 12, of course, is spin zero. So that's actually a convenient thing, because then carbon 13 is a dilute nuclei. Most carbons, carbon 12. And so if you're synthesizing a molecule, you can put C13 where you want it to be. So you can use it as a chemical marker. Nitrogen 14, spin 1. Nitrogen 15, spin 1/2. Phosphorus 31, spin 1/2. Fluorine 19, spin 1/2. And those two are 100% natural abundant. There's only one isotope of phosphorus and fluorine. So these things are nice. This, of course, is 1%. This is close, right? But there's a little bit of this. And tritium, of course, is radioactive. Yeah. Okay, so we have these two energy levels. And what the figure tells us is that the Z state is the one that sets the energy. Sets the energy because we've just applied the magnetic field along the Z-axis. There's nothing magical about that. And so the Hamiltonian is going to be gamma B0 sigma Z divided by 2. And this thing we will call omega naught. And yeah, that's okay. All right, so the magnet. So we have this magnetic moment. We're going to apply a strong magnetic field. And even in a strong magnetic field, the energy separation is going to be small. So if I take a field of 2.35 tesla, and I'm looking at protons, then this is 100 megahertz. Experimentally, if you have a permanent magnet, you can get up to about 2.5 tesla. And you can buy these wickedly strong little permanent magnets and get yourself in trouble. If you take, yeah.
I'm sorry, I don't actually know this, but so we've only seen, so we've seen two fields so far, right? B naught and the Earth's magnetic field. And B naught is definitely large compared to the Earth's magnetic field. But when you say it's, even though B naught is large, the energy splitting is small, what are you comparing it to there?
I'm going to compare it to temperature.
Okay.
So,
So we've got, so I was saying this goes up to, that's about the range of a permanent magnet. We can make magnets out of superconductors, so I can wrap a bobbin of superconducting wire, put a current through it, close the switch, current will flow forever as long as I keep the superconducting wire cold. And of course there's no energy loss. And superconducting magnets, today we can get up to about 25 tesla. We can make bitter magnets, so water-cooled magnets that can get up to 30, 32 tesla. We can combine bitter magnets and conducting magnets, we can get up to 45 tesla. We can do nice things of taking a loop of copper and closing it with a big capacitor across it. And we can get up to 60 tesla. If you have them really, really small, you can get up a little bit higher than that. If you can close the switch quickly, the way we close the switch normally is to shoot a bullet through the contacts. And so one moment you can get for a microsecond. In one shot, you can get a very high field. And then we can explosively compress a field. and then we can get a little bit higher, so that you can go up to 100 tesla. But for our purposes, a few tesla is where we want to be. So if I look at the ratio of the number of spins in the up state divided by the number of spins in the down state, and I guess I should have done this the other way. So this is going to be e to the minus h bar omega naught over kt, just Boltzmann's equation. And this is going to be about 1 minus 10 to the minus 5. So at room temperature, I should have said that. Matters a lot. 300 Kelvin. The populations of spin up and spin down are just about the same. There's a small excess here, but it's only, tens of parts per million. And therefore, in order to detect a sample, we're going to use a macroscopic sample. And if I have water and I have 1 micron cubed of water, that's 10 to the 11 spins. So here you say, well, this looks really bad. But of course, Avogadro's number remains big. And so here I still have a million spins pointing in the right direction at the price of having 10 to the 11 spins in my sample. Yeah? Okay. So before World War II, this was known. And of course, it had been seen, right? Stern Gerlach had done their experiment. And Robbie had done an experiment in molecular beams to show that you could rotate the nuclear spin state. But there had been no demonstration of coherence in a bulk sample. And during the war, that Holland was invaded, but it wasn't conscripted. And so, the country was invaded and people were told to stay home and not cause trouble. So they stayed home, caused a bit of trouble. But Goethe, who was at the University of Rotterdam, well, the universities were closed. But he took his students and said, let's try to do the best physics we can. So he had a small group of people. And of course, he's doing his physics. He's an experimentalist. He's doing his physics in a place where it's a miracle if there's any power. It's hard to have something to eat, never mind having a magnet with a field to do an experiment. And so he goes through and figures out what do you need to do a whole slew of really great hard experiments. And he and his students go through, describe them, try to set them up, and he publishes a series of papers, Failure to See, fill in the blank for someone else's Nobel Prize. And so he publishes a paper that says, failure to see magnetic resonance, where he gets everything right. The experimental setup is right. The physics is, of course, right. But he doesn't see it. Now, during the war, Bloch and Purcell were at the MIT radiation lab. And that's where It's actually one of the many, many, many places it claims to develop radar. But they too. And so, you know, they're working at the cusp of electrical engineering and physics. And afterwards, they know that seeing NMR in a bulk sample is an important thing. And so they both run off back to their academic homes to do that. So Purcell just down the road to Harvard and Bloch to Stanford. Now, Purcell, I hope you know about as the writer of this beautiful book on electricity and magnetism. And Bloch, you better know about as a theorist who developed the Bloch waves. So they both go back, they set up the experiment, they do the experiment, it of course works because they have good equipment, and they publish it. They publish it back to back. And Purcell, who's, you know, the classical classical physicist, he publishes the quantum description of magnetic resonance. Bloch, you know, for his development of quantum mechanics, publishes the classical description of magnetic resonance. Now, the reason Bloch publishes a classical description is he proves that the quantum description is isomorphic to, can be mapped onto the classical description, and that you capture all of the physics of the system. So it's not, of course, that he doesn't believe in quantum mechanics, but it was the most compact way of describing the physics. And so we end up with a set of equations called Bloch's equations, which give you a complete and correct description for an ensemble of spin 1/2 particles. I mean, if you're talking about having a classical picture, then you better be looking at the expectation values, right? And so that's what he's going to tell us, is that he can look at the dynamics of expectation values. Poor Goethe gets forgotten. Although throughout that time in physics, he was very influential. And one of the reasons that Goethe fails to see the signal, and almost that the Harvard group fails to see the signal, is at this point, they didn't know how the system was going to relax. So I had the system in the Earth's magnetic field. Well, the Earth's magnetic field, this is 10 to the minus 10 now, right? It's not 10 to the minus 5. And so in the Earth's magnetic field, these two levels are exactly, not exactly, but you know, almost exactly equally populated. So you put your sample in a high magnetic field, and it has to come to thermal equilibrium, right? There has to be more likely that a spin that is pointing down is going to flip to pointing up than it is that a spin that's pointing up will flip to going down, right? And you saw that in Joseph's course where he talked about Krauss operators and looking at polarizing channels, I hope. And it was at this point, people didn't know how that would happen. And remember, it's a very low frequency. That here I have 100 megahertz, but their experiments were done at about 20 megahertz. 100 megahertz was a high frequency back then. So now then you've got this spin that needs to flip. And you say, well, how can it get energy to do that? And the only thing that had been seen, of course, was molecular beam experiments. In a molecular beam experiment, you don't need to polarize a sample, right? You take the sample, and in a magnetic field gradient, you split into two beams, spin up and spin down. So the action of that gradient in the motion creates the polarization, right? You don't have, there's no thermal process in a molecular beam experiment. And so then they would say, well, okay, what do we know? Well, they knew at this time what the spontaneous emission rate was for a magnetic dipole. And you might remember that the spontaneous emission rate goes as frequency to the inverse fourth power. And so if I calculate the spontaneous emission rate, so the rate that I'm going to exchange energy with the vacuum for a dipole at 100 megahertz, it's age of the universe. And so then it's a drag, right? You know, either you go out and find some place where water has been sitting in this field since the start of the universe, hard to do, or you have to wait around a while. And so here, when they thought about it a little bit too much, they said, well, maybe we shouldn't see the signal because maybe it will never be polarized. In Goethe's case, that prevented him from improving his sample, his apparatus, that at some point he decides, oh, well, we shouldn't see it anyways. In Purcell's case, they had the wrong gyromagnetic ratio. So their field was sitting too high. And they were looking, and they said, well, okay, it doesn't work. And you know, if you make a big magnet, you have to have lots and lots and lots of turns. So the inductance is huge. And so when you disconnect the power supply, well, don't do that. When you turn down the power supply, if you disconnect the power supply, what happens? You get electrocuted. Okay? Right? Because you disconnect it, and then, you know, you're saying, oh, well, what's the voltage? You know, it's LDI dt, right? Okay, so that's bad. Don't disconnect it. But you can turn it down. But it'll still take a long time to ramp down. So while it's ramping down and Purcell leaves the lab, his graduate student says, hey, what was that? That there was a blip on the oscilloscope. And so he gets Purcell back and they find the resonance. Okay. So enough of stories. Here we have that, and the take-home message is: be persistent, and don't accept too simplistic an argument that you should go home early. So now that we have the system, it's polarized. How is it actually polarized? It's polarized because the spins in your sample are all magnets, and so that if I have a sample of water, then the protons are going to see all of the other protons moving around. And you would say, oh, if I look at the mechanical motions, they're all at too high a frequency to couple to this, but I can have a Raman transition. I can have two mechanical motions where the difference in frequency allows me to have a spin flip. And so that's the way that we get this to be not the age of the universe, in the case of water, about 3 seconds. Good. Okay. So now we have our sample. And since I work in magnetic resonance, you know it must be simple. So the only thing that we have here is the two eigenstates. We apply a magnetic field, and you know classically, and so it has to be true quantum mechanically, that all of the dynamics are a torque. If I have a magnetic moment in a magnetic field, the motion is a torque. So all of the dynamics And of course, that's what this says, right? That the dynamics are to rotate about the z-axis. So we have our Bloch sphere. And if I had the magnetic moment sitting here, then it would precess about that, and it would precess with a frequency given by omega naught. And unfortunately, the language of NMR, and thus the language of all spin 1/2 systems, grew out of the motion of tops, which at that moment was assumed that every physics student understood how a top works. And so tops are much more complicated than spins. But we have precession because the top precesses. And later on we'll have nutation. And nutation is the wobbling that you see in a top. Precession, of course, is the rotation. Okay, now we can start to write down Bloch's equations. So we're going to write down Bloch's equations for the expectation value of sigma x, sigma y, and sigma z. But we remember that what we have is an ensemble that has many, many copies, that has something approaching Avogadro's number of copies. And therefore, instead of writing it down, instead of indexing it like that, we index it as the total magnetic moment over all the spins. So you take mu and add your Avogadro's number of spins up, and you get some effective big magnetic moment. And this says that we have a frequency omega naught, which is going to carry this to y, and dy dt is, let's see, so there's a negative sign there. And so I have a term here that is going to allow me to have precession. Okay, so this is just a rotation. That's no surprise there. And of course, for the z component, this term will be zero, right? Because the magnetic moment along z commutes with the Hamiltonian. Yeah.
But now you're talking about adding the spins together, which is kind of like an...
That's a great question. So the statement is, why, if I tell you that there's a tensor product structure, am I talking about the sum of the magnetic moment? I'm not talking about the tensor product of Avogadro's number of spins, which would be much more interesting, right? We could really fill the board quickly. All of these spins are chemically the same. And so there's no way for the correct basis, if I wrote down all of the spins, would be in the Dickey basis. I would describe all the spins, and I would keep only the part which is symmetric under swapping of any two spins. And so what we're going to see is that we'll end up having a tensor product structure, but the tensor product structure will come because we've added spins that are chemically distinct. And so they'll be, so let's look at a simple example. It's not simple chemistry, but it's a simple example. If I look at this molecule, and if I wrote it correctly, so dibromyl thiophene, there's two spins there, there's two protons. And I hope you'll agree with me that they're chemically distinct, that this one's next to the sulfur and that one's not. Okay? And since they're chemically distinct, they'll actually have different resonance frequencies. That if I have a nuclear spin, then it's going to be surrounded by an electron cloud. And that electron cloud, Lenz's law is going to tell us, is going to arrange itself as to try to suppress the field, to try to screen the field, right? It's always going to arrange itself in opposition of the applied field. Now, it's only one poor little electron, or maybe two in this case. So it can't do very much. But the resonance frequencies of these two are differ by about 1.5 parts per million of the static magnetic field. And that'll become important in Wednesday's class. But there, I would have to write down a tensor product structure because I have distinguishable spins. And the parts per million sounds small, but the line width in magnetic resonance is parts per billion. So it's good. We can see parts per million easily. Okay. What is that? What do you mean?
I don't know if I'm understood correctly, but if I wanted to have a big tensor product structure, then I basically have to have a huge molecule where each of those are distinct. So if I wanted to use this for quantum information processing, I wanted to have, say, I don't know, a many qubit system, then it's like this group of that.
Yeah. So that too is a great question. So you're saying, look, if this is my way of creating distinguishable spins, and I want to have, 100 distinguishable spins, then I need to create the chemistry such that all of them are separated by some amount. And for protons, the full range of the chemical shift is 10 parts per million. So then you say, okay, I have 10 parts per million. I need to fit 100 resonances in there. And I need to find that magic compound that does this, right? And that's very hard. And for that reason, although magnetic resonance in the liquid state is a great way of investigating quantum behavior, it's a lousy way to make a quantum computer. Good way to make quantum processors. A quantum computer says that you can scale it big, that you can do error correction, and that you have, as the problem size increases, the probability of getting the right result doesn't decrease. And that wouldn't be the case here. I'll show you on Thursday that we don't have to have all of the information in the molecule. So we are trying to build quantum computers in the solid state, not the liquid state, that would be at 100 qubit level, and we'll avoid this problem.
This expectation value means that we're ignoring all interactions between
those
spins.
That's right. So I'm saying explicitly that there are no interactions between the spins. And that I'll justify tomorrow. but you're absolutely right. So now, here we have this bulk magnetization vector that's processing, and we know the eigenstates. They're here and here, right? Those are the eigenstates of our Hamiltonian. Of course, really, if I was looking at all spins polarized and all spins down, they're way up there and way down there. But, you know, we're never going to get there. This is the thermal state. And so there needs to be a way to get from here to here. And so we need two actions. One, we need the vector along the x and y direction to shrink. So that means there has to be noise along the z-axis. And so we're going to add and I will justify this term for you as well, but not again today. And so this is the dephasing, or it's a lack of coherence in the system, right? And this time t2 is the one that we already talked about. And there needs to be some way that m sub z gets back to its thermal state. And so there needs to be a term that is m naught minus mz over some other constant T1, and M naught is the equilibrium value. And so we exponentially get back there. And this piece, of course, is a polarizing channel. The piece that I wanted to get to today was to show you how do I get to this initial state. If I simply put the spins in the magnetic field and I wait, then they're going to be polarized here. And so far, I have a Hamiltonian that's along the z-axis. So that Hamiltonian isn't going to rotate the state along z at all. It'll simply leave the state there. So how do we get and we get there by applying an alternating field along the x-axis. So here, of course, we have a field along the x-axis, and here's an alternation. And I'm going to sketch it out, and then I'll go over it next class. But here we have this field that's going back and forth along the x-axis. And if I have a field, or if I have a signal, which is an amplitude modulation, then you can always decompose it into a sum of two phase modulations. Or if I have an interaction which is alternating along one direction, I can always think about it as the sum of two rotations that are going in opposite directions. And of course, you know that, right? Because I can say, oh, well, sure, I can rewrite this as e to the I omega t t plus e to the minus I omega t t, and I should divide by 2, right? No magic there. And so now then we have two fields that we've applied. Now remember that the spins are rotating. So I'm going to take one of these fields, and I'm going to make those two frequencies just about equal. And when I do that, then you can see that because the spin is rotating and the field's rotating, that the field can have an effect on the spin. Imagine if I applied a field along the x-axis, which was weak compared to this field. Okay? It has to be weak. If I apply a field along the x-axis, then what happens? Well, we say, this is easy. I've got a field here that is 23,500 Gauss. I'm going to apply a field here, which is of order 1 to 2 Gauss. And if they're stationary, then you say, well, okay, that's easy. You're going to rotate about that effective direction, which is close enough to being rotating about that field, and so this thing effectively does nothing. You know, it's not that you can't find that it does something, but to a good approximation, it does nothing. But now, and the reason I like to think it does nothing is take the spins that are evolving around this. Use a different color. Take the spins. And let's just have them evolving around the strong field. Well, then they're over here. This field is trying to push them down. But they're revolving. When they're over here, it's trying to push them up. And so as it goes around, it gets tilted a little bit, but there's no real change. Now, do something else. Take this field and only apply it when the spins are here. Well, then I say, okay, I'm going to apply it. You'll push it down a little bit. Then I turn it off, let the spins go around. They come here. I push it down a little bit, right? And then that would accumulate. And that's what we're going to do here. We're going to take our alternating field. We're going to break it into rotating and counter-rotating field. We'll take the rotating field and we'll show that because it's on resonance, recall, it's nuclear magnetic resonance, that's the resonance piece. Because it's on resonance, you'll be able to rotate the spin state. And, of course, it'll tell us that we should go into a rotating frame. And so we'll look at the rotating wave approximation. And once we do that, we'll be able to throw away the counter-rotating field and get our dynamics. Okay? We'll do all that tomorrow. Any questions? Okay, then thanks.